You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to extend a special thanks to the family of Siamak Porzand, to Mehrangi Zekar, to her two daughters, Leili and Azadeh Porzand, and to her son-in-law, Mehrdad Hariri, who have spoken this morning. And I will reference a bit of what they said in my introduction to this discussion, which really does follow on the legacy of the life and work of Siamak Porzand and brings the discussion into some of the contemporary issues that we're facing today in Iran. I am deeply honored to be here in tribute to an individual and to his family whose lives and work are really an inspiration, not just to Iranians, but all those of us who are outside Iran and care about the country and try to follow and understand the country. And I'm very much honored to be among a group of people sitting here on this stage and also in the audience here who have been directly engaged in carrying on the important dual dimensions. I don't want to talk about two-track policies, but the dual dimensions of the life and legacy of Siamak Porzand, that is to say, both the art and writing and journalism that was his métier, but also the long struggle for human rights and democracy that was inherent in everything that he did and all of the work that he produced. So I'm deeply honored to be here. We spent 9 months trying to pull this conference together, really in the days after learning of the death of Siamak. We came together and have been trying to come up with a panel that would appropriately honor his work and really find a way to use that to address a set of issues that too often get overshadowed by everything else that the world focuses on with respect to Iran. And I will say that over the course of those 9 months, there were a number of times where I thought it just might never happen. We might never be able to find a time where Hale and Karim and everyone were all in the same country at the same time, where we would be able to find a room in an institution here in Washington, which is often more complicated than it ought to be. But I could have never imagined that it would come together as phenomenally successfully as it has today. I think we have just the right array of people to address the set of issues that we hope to address today. A really brilliant group of panelists over the course of this morning and after lunch, which will follow this panel. And I think the timing, ironically, has worked out in a very important fashion, which is to say that anywhere that you go in Washington over the course of the past 4 to 6 months, there's been only one or two issues on the agenda. One is war, the other is the nuclear issue. That is all that anyone has any space or time to talk about. It is vital that we find a way to change the subject, not to change the subject from Iran, but to broaden the terms of our understanding of Iran, to ensure that the stories of individuals like Siamak Porzand, the life and work that he embodied, and that of his family, Mehrangi Zekar, who is in and of herself a well-known advocate for human rights. So I'm just thrilled to be here and thrilled that so many of you are squished together in this small room or standing out front in the overflow area, and I look forward to having a really terrific conversation. The reality is you're not here to listen to me, you're here to listen to these three gentlemen, and I'm here to listen and learn from them as well. You have in front of you their bios. They're three really terrific and phenomenal individuals whose work in several different areas is quite important to the issues that we're here to talk about today. Media, information, technology, and journalism. These are very much areas of ferment in Iran for many, many years. Iran has this incredible press tradition which stretches back over the course of at least a century, and which has mutated and evolved in ways in response, particularly over the course of the past 15 years, to the incredible repression that has been wrought by this regime. So it's a battleground, as well as an area of incredible entrepreneurism. And for that reason, we've brought together Mehdi Yahyahnejad, whose website, Balaterin, is well known to anyone who has an interest in Iran and social networking. He is a researcher at the University of Southern California and flew cross country to be here with us today. Our second panelist will be Nika Hankosar. Again, if you've followed writing about Iran, or for that matter, even if you don't read Persian, if you've ever seen a political cartoon with incredible power, an incredible relevance. It was almost certainly done by this gentleman, and his website and his continued work in writing on Iran is something that anyone who is interested in understanding the current political dynamics follows. Our third panelist, Henry Wooster, is here with us as Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Policy, focused specifically on Iran. Henry has an incredible background on Iran and is going to speak about some of the real contributions that have been made over the course of the past decade by the U.S. government in trying to reach out to Iranians and trying to ensure that Iranians have access to information and technology. With that, let me turn the discussion over to Mehdi, and we'll speak again for about 5 to 7 minutes. I will not probably be quite as close on the clock as Holly was, but I will try to enforce some discipline so that we can get to a conversation among all three of these gentlemen and then with all of you who are listening. Thank you.
Thank you. In the past few months, you might have seen a number of articles in New York Times or in other newspapers that question the importance of internet in cases of Arab Spring and also in Iran in terms of how important internet has been in mobilizing people and creating what happened, especially in Arab countries. For Iranian government, there is no question that internet is could be disruptive and dangerous for their stability. And what I'm going to do just summarize some of the things that Iranian government is doing to make sure that its internet is not going to disrupt their stability and their government. So in the past few years, the Iranian government has increasingly improved their control of internet. Iranian government has been active on several fronts. The first is internet censorship. As early as year 2002, Iranian government started internet filtering based on domain names and keywords. They have used both imported and also internally developed technologies to confront censorship. Increasingly, they adjust the level of censorship based on the political events of the day. So if there is a demonstration happening or they're expecting a demonstration to happen, they usually try to block access to secure internet connections. Sometimes they block Gmail, and also they increase the attacks on opposition websites. So it's a time-based, they adjust their level of control, and they usually expect what's happening and they try to make predictions. So the second activity they are increasingly involved in is surveillance. And Iranian government has imported technologies and also built technologies to monitor the activities of the activists on the web and also mobile. For example, for mobile, they have developed software to look for specific keywords in text messages and also identify individuals who forward these type of messages to a number of people, so a large number of people. For internet, they monitor the unencrypted web traffic. For example, Yahoo email is unencrypted, and any email sent through Yahoo mail is visible to Iranian government, and they definitely log the content because that's, we've heard a number of stories from people who have been confronted with the content of their email messages in prison. Activists in prison are regularly forced to confess after they are presented by the content of their communications. And also another method of surveillance is hacking into computers and email accounts of the activists. Iranian government has become fairly sophisticated in this regard, and most political activists inside and outside Iran underestimate how sophisticated Iranian government is in such type of activities. And on suspecting a PowerPoint file containing several funny images or jokes could be in fact something that's been created by the Iranian government in order to hack into the email accounts of the activists. And such PowerPoint files could be passed around by just people who are trying to just send a funny joke to their friends by email. The third front that Iranian government has been fairly active is content production. They have tried to increase the production of content sympathetic to their cause. This is done partly through the website they've set up. I mean, you've know about First News, you know about Kayhan. I mean, the news that publishes their propaganda and content and news. But also, they are using what they call cyber officers. This is separate from cyber army. There is a cyber army, which is basically a secret group of hackers, and they hack into email accounts and laptops and so on. But these are cyber officers are probably less sophisticated technically, but they are people who go and leave comments on the web. And they are usually like leaving comments about sympathy to the Iranian government or sometimes attacking dissidents. They, in some cases, they publish personal information, usually embarrassing for those dissidents, and they work in a very coordinated fashion. In fact, a few months ago, in a very rare public infighting between Iranian government supporters, it was disclosed how much they are paid on hourly basis. And in fact, then there was some a number of other websites who said, no, this is not the case. They're working for free and it's all bam. But the source was very credible, and it's believed that the amount was fairly accurate. So this, one of the, in fact, Iranian Revolutionary Guard has claimed that they have trained 1,500 cyber officers so far, and they are active on the web. And there have been reports of people who have seen such cyber officers hanging around in cyber cafes and working on leaving comments on the web. Another area the Iranian government has been recently very active is what they call halal internet or national internet. And by that, what they're trying to do is basically what's happening for postal mail, like in any country, usually the internal mail goes through the inside the country. For example, if there's a letter going from Los Angeles to Boston, it's not going to go through Toronto. But in case of internet, since it's a global network, the traffic doesn't recognize borders and it goes through borders. In this case, Iranian government once tries to separate the internal communication from the outside communication. And by doing that, they could allow the speed of internet within Iran to go higher, because there would be less technical force to do the surveillance. But they keep the speed of internet connections with the outside country to the same level as it is now. So they will be able to keep their surveillance as it is for the international communication. So pretty much they are implementing what's done for postal mail, but for internet, which is kind of like counterintuitive. But in their case, it makes sense, and it's partly because of their technical limitation, because they don't have enough technical power to do the surveillance that they are doing for if they increase the speed of internet. So they want to make sure that they are separating the internal traffic from external traffic and continue their surveillance on the external traffic. So I stop it here, and we can continue in the Q&A.
This was not an ad for me that's been over here all the time. And I'm happy that Karim didn't tell me that the whole thing took 9 months. I would have drawn a cartoon of giving birth of a conference. Thank God he didn't tell me. Probably you might say, what do I mean to be and not to be? It's to be or not to be. But in Iran, actually, we as journalists are journalists and activists. And this is something wrong. So I just want to talk about some things. But before everything, I want to salute Siamak Purzan and also his lovely family. And just last night, I was going through my cartoons. I remember that the cartoon that actually sent me to Evin, and I had a lot of fun over there, was a cartoon that Siamak was present at the editorial meeting at the Azad newspaper when we were trying to coin a name for the character. This was the cartoon. It's famous as Ostad Tensor, Professor Crocodile, that from that day that it was published, they know Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi as the Crocodile. And I made Crocodile so famous in Iran, but Lacoste didn't sponsor me. So now this is the real Crocodile, the original one. And one important thing that all of us are scared of is imprisonment. But we don't usually understand that we are imprisoning the guys in charge of the prison, because they have to take care of us in prison. So if we just look at it backwards, we know how to give a hard time to our guards and the judges. And of course, it's not that easy. I'm just probably joking. But if you have been interrogated by somebody like Mortazavi, he interrogated me for 3.5 hours just because of that crocodile cartoon. And I gave him a hard time. Of course, he gave me 6 days in Evin, but it was lovely. Many of us have gone to prison for not breaking the law. That's the problem. We did not break the law. We did everything, I should say, between the thin red lines, between the thin red borders that we had. But it doesn't matter to the government, or it's not to the government, to the judiciary. In Iran, we have censorship and self-censorship. This is the problem that really exists. We have to censor ourselves every day, not because of just what the government might think of our writing or our creation, but even the political parties that possibly are supporting or sponsoring the newspapers that we are working for. That's the big problem that we have. Mr. Toscano was talking about creation and ideology. That's the big problem we have in reformist newspapers that many of us worked for. This is a good example of how the government wants journalists to be. Speechless. And the red lines that are actually limiting us are not that thin sometimes. They might crush us. Now we go to Mr. Rigg. This was published by Washington Post in 2009. I am not free to draw such a cartoon in Iran, but I'm lucky to be out of the country and draw the cartoon and publish it through my syndicate, New York Times Syndicate, and other places. But the thing is, as long as I'm drawing something against Ahmadinejad, many websites would actually republish the cartoon. But if I criticize the reformist leaders, you will be labeled as a member of the regime. Sorry, this was published by Toronto Star. It's when Ahmadinejad almost won 63% of the vote, and it could be considered a finger. So this gentleman wins the vote and dances with anybody. And I call this the last tango in Tehran, but I think he has been dancing with others as well. I don't know. With respect to the last tango in Paris, what will happen next. While journalists cannot freely work, citizen journalists have been actually been creative and passing the information to the world about what is happening in Iran. I drew this in 2009 when the videos of the events on the streets in Tehran were actually broadcast on different TV stations through the videos people had posted on YouTube. And that was an very important thing, that while journalists, Mr. Bahari was arrested, or Nazilah Fati didn't have permission to actually do anything, I think, and she had to leave the country later, citizen journalists were the ones who were carrying out the whole thing. And if you're a journalist working even out of the country, you might be in a lot of trouble. Many of you might have heard that a journalist working for BBC Persian in London was interrogated through Skype because they had taken her sister hostage. And this was the first time that we noticed this had happened. And I'm sure this has been going on and on. That the Iranian government, you know, Iranians, I mean the government agents are hostage takers. Mr. Limpert is not here, but he'll be here in the afternoon. He's a very good example. An Iranian regime is the best hostage-taking government in the world. They know what to do. The worst. And so even if you're out of the country, they can harass your family members. Two of my family members have been sort of harassed in the past few years. I know it. And you'll be in a lot of pressure. But the problem is, do you bow to pressure? Because if you bow to pressure, the whole thing will continue. Now I want to criticize Iranian journalism in a way. Of course, I'm talking about a minority of journalists, a few thousand of them. One thing, you are supposed to be loyal to the citizens, but unfortunately, many of us are loyal to the party leaders or the government. And we have self-censorship here as well. I'll come back to that. And the other thing is we do not verify the news very well. Here, I've tied the eyes of this guy with a green band. I just want to tell you that many of the green websites are silent to what has happened to Iranian dissidents, to Iranian activists before 2009. Human rights abuse has been there for more than 33 years. But so many people are trying to just emphasize on what has happened after 2009. It sells in the human rights, if you can call it business. It sells. But no, the problem is, if people had been more active against human rights abuse in the past, against the Baha'is, against the political activists, probably we wouldn't have seen what we have seen since 2009. Independence. Many of us are not independent. We are possibly related to a political party or a group. And then we want to say that, no, we're the victors of your independent. No, it doesn't sound right. And many of us are not independent monitors of power. We just monitor the ones our publishers want to be monitored. And our first obligation in journalism should be to the truth. And truthfully, many of us have sometimes lied. And now the reformists, I just brought this because this cartoon was censored 3 days ago. I won't mention the website that censored it. You can find out yourselves. But the thing is, I just drew Mr. Khatami going for the 2013 elections, and he has to play by the leader's rules. And just this cartoon was censored. And the answer was, I asked the editor, why do you censor it? And she told me, it's not relevant. So what's relevant? Mr. Khatami has been all over the news just because of his casting his vote in Damavand about 2 months ago. And he has been talking about participation in the elections and everything. But it's censored. So finally, one of my very good colleagues, Mr. Safsari, is here. He's a good representative of all those journalists who had to leave the country after the 2009 election. And many of us have had to leave the country because of the death threats we've received, the pressures we've received, had to go to hospital. And many people like Siamak Purzand didn't want to leave, or when they wanted to leave, they couldn't. We were the lucky ones. So, see you next time, of course, if you're not crucified, as many journalists have somehow been crucified by the Iranian regime. Thank you very much.
as a representative of the U.S. government, of course, grossly unfair to have to follow someone with a sense of humor. I'll remember that. It's especially tough to follow our cartoonist and a political one. thank you, Suzanne. Thank you for inviting me. And to the Pourzan family, I salute CIAMAC. Ironically, the aspect of U.S.-Iran policy that's least covered by the media is, in fact, our use of the media and of technology to maintain connections to millions of Iranians. The United States has had diplomatic ties with Iran for about 100 years, or let me correct that, had diplomatic ties with Iran for about 100 years. We see the past 33-plus years as more of an anomaly. Beyond that, we've had a shared history that's much longer. So here we are now, separated from, depending upon your demographics, about 78 million people. I'm, of course, not including the regime in that count. The president recently, in his Nowruz address, said there's no reason for the United States and for Iran to be divided from one another. The secretary has made similar remarks. So how do we maintain this relationship and build on it despite the differences that we've had between our governments and despite now the passing of generations? In large part, the answer is the focus of today's conversation: information, communications, the media. In April 2011, we appointed our first dedicated Persian language spokesman, Alan Eyre, who, by the way, regrets that he could not be here today. Through his numerous appearances on television, radio, and on online interviews, he's had over 60 of them to date. He's reached millions and millions of Iranians. And the United States government has a voice inside Iran. Because of the effect this position has had, the department's worked to make it permanent, to train potential successors for Alan. We convinced the secretary to address the Iranian people in two interviews in October of 2011, the first time during her tenure. The interviews were viewed by as many as 20 million people inside Iran. We saw a public dialogue between some of the recognized leaders of the reformist and opposition groups in the diaspora as a result. In addition, the secretary has done video announcements for a change, for instance, in visa policies for Iranian students, for the launch of the Virtual Embassy Tehran. Let me speak about the Virtual Embassy for a second. In December of last year, when we launched it, it was poo-pooed immediately by the government through official announcements. And, of course, we watched very carefully to see what sort of hits we were getting, what number of hits, and where they were coming from. While we were watching this and the government in Tehran was making announcements about it's nothing, we then began to see a spike in terms of the hits that we were getting inside Iran. That lasted about 36 to 48 hours. Then there was a huge drop-off from inside Iran, but an extraordinary number of hits and a fair bit of exchange and dialogue in Persian, out of Nigeria, out of the Bahamas, and out of a lot of other curious locations. It's called Virtual Protocol Network, for those of you who are wondering. In other words, if you build it, they will come. If you make the content sufficiently compelling, by the way, always a challenge, they will find the site and they will find a way to it. So the idea behind the Virtual Embassy was to consolidate in one place all of our information about Iran. So if you were interested in a visa, and of course a lot of people are, you could go to one place and you could find that. If you're interested in what in fact is U.S. policy about the nuclear issue, you could find that. And what we didn't want to do was to have people going to disparate sites to go to sort of stray voltage, quite literally, all over the Internet. We wanted them to be able to go to one place that was an official United States government place that put the official U.S. position out on our policy. We've had about 2 million hits now on the site. We've hosted 450,000-plus visitors on it. Our Persian language social media brand, USA Dar Farsi, that has been a success as well. Our Facebook page, mind you, this is the U.S. government, so I would like to say that it's Google, and I had fantastical numbers for you. But mind you, keep the relative standard and measure, please. Our Facebook page has over 60,000 fans, about half of whom claim to reside inside Iran. Our Twitter feed has over 10,000 followers, and videos subtitled in Persian on our YouTube site have been watched over 600,000 times. We've also just launched a site on Google Plus, and with help from Google, the State Department has hosted the first Google Hangout. It's a live video chat feature. I didn't know what it was either as the father of four teenagers. I had to have it explained to me. On this site, Alan is answering questions in Persian. He answers questions from Persian journalists, from Persian bloggers, and also when we open it up publicly to anyone coming in, writing in questions in Persian, or for that matter, calling them in. There are very few actual U.S. embassy sites around the world with more fans and followers, despite the additional obstacles and risks that Iranians face in trying to access this site, a mark of their moral courage and of their shrewdness and cleverness. Both the United Kingdom and France have followed our lead, creating UK for Iranians, and most recently the French with La France en Iran brands. So pulling all these efforts together, what's the idea? It's unified around the notion of piercing what we refer to as the electronic curtain. You may have seen, or you may not, I hope you have, our what we call the animated fact sheet, in other words, a video. This is depicting Iran's censorship at work. You can find it on humanrights.gov, where it's hosted. You can also find it on Virtual Embassy Tehran on our website. So we're trying to tackle the problem of the electronic curtain in a number of ways. We're helping to train Iranian journalists, civil society activists, and others in ways to use the internet safely. We're continuing to support broadcasting through the Voice of America, Persian, through Radio Farda. We've been working with international partners to call more attention to the extent of Iranian government satellite jamming. We've begun to find ways to ensure that our sanctions policy, which is broad, does not impede the ability of Iranians to access internet software that's distributed by U.S. companies. And here I'm thinking of Java, Flash, Skype. This is a real brief overview. It's just a sketch of what we have been up to of late in terms of media, communications, social media platforms. This is all driven at our push to get connection with the Iranian people, both to boost morale and also to have access to them and to know what's going on in the country insofar as we can access them. We're very aware that the majority of Iranians do not get their information through the internet. So of the 78 million population, and again, numbers differ on this, but I've watched them for a bit, the majority of folks are getting the base of the pyramid, if you will, are getting their information through broadcast media, primarily through state, not State Department, but Iranian state official media. Jamming, again, impedes our ability to operate in that environment. We do a lot on it as it is, going around it through circumvention of a variety of means, not just on the internet. But this remains a challenge for us. We're doing fairly well on the internet, on social media, but the broadcast remains the next new challenge. In a recent speech that Secretary Clinton gave on the pillars of soft power, or soft power, she cited the efforts that we've made to engage Iranians through social media, through the internet, as one of the examples. This is beyond what we're doing with Iran throughout the Department of State. This is also increasingly 21st century statecraft. And I see this more and more with the officers that we get into, the Foreign Service and elsewhere in the department. They're younger, they're more adept. It's intuitive for them to operate in this fashion. Older dogs like myself, we've had to learn it at the knees of our teenagers or our younger officers. But it's an intuitive way to operate for increasingly large numbers of the population. We don't have to train them, teach them, have talks with them about why this is important. They get it. They're already present intellectually. They're already adept at maneuvering there. Again, just a brief sketch at what we're doing and how we're doing it to support democracy, the free flow of information, and human rights through these social media tools. Thank you.
Thank you so much to each of you for three really rich and diverse presentations. I am going to abuse the prerogative of sitting up here to ask a couple of questions and then turn it over to all of you because I know that there's probably a lot of discussion around these very issues. I want to start with Mehdi because you were I think, very humble in your presentation. You talked a lot about what the Iranian government has done to impede access to the internet and to distract young Iranians and others who might be seeking information and try to deter them through their own content production and others. You didn't talk about Balasharin, which I know is very well known to many, many people here. But I want you to talk a little bit about the site, about the contributions that it's made, and why you're so familiar with some of the efforts of the Iranian government to hack and to impede access, because this is exactly what they've done to your site. So tell us some more about Balasharin and where you're going from here.
So Balasharin is a social news website. People can submit summary of links, summary of news to the other that are published on other websites, and other users vote up and comment on the links and post things. The website itself, I started 5 years ago, and the original intention wasn't anything like necessarily a dissident action or anything political per se. And in fact, at the beginning, most of the postings were cultural or scientific. And but as time went on, just because of the freedom on the site, a lot more political voices and more social issues to become more prominent. And as time went on, in fact, the site moved toward more social and political political issues. Iranian government started by blocking the website in Iran. Later, in fact, the cyber officers showed up back in 2008 trying to overtake the website, but. And but what happened, because of course they were a minority, there was a reaction by the dominant group of users. In 2009, the hacking activities by Cyber Army, which is operated by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, started. And then it came the demonstration in 2009, and Balasharin became a kind of central place for brainstorming about ideas and what to do next. And in a number of cases, some of the ideas that first presented in comment sections of Balasharin became things that people actually did. And in some cases, they worked. In some cases, they didn't work. And censorship has got worse. So most of the contributions these days are coming from Iranians who are outside Iran. The website has a lot of readership inside Iran, but still, I think majority of the content are posted by users outside Iran. And since there is a gap between Iranians outside Iran and Iranians inside Iran, it's usually like once the contributions are coming from people outside Iran, there is Iranians inside Iran don't feel that these are necessarily relevant in some cases. And Iranians who are in exile or who are outside the country are often, what they want is in a way more not necessarily in line with what is practical inside Iran or what can be achievable at least in the short term. One thing I want to add is I think one important Balasharin has been the diversity of opinions. It's pretty much the one achievement of Balasharin I think I'm very proud of is that you could pretty much find anything, like every single type of Iranian opinion Balasharin. And whenever something happens, I definitely know, I could run this type of conversation in my mind and kind of predict what people are going to say because I've seen so many comments. So, you have, Iranians support a green movement. You have Iranians who are very cynical about any change. You have Iranians supporting monarchy. You have Iranians, support Iranian government, religious versus non-religious. And I think it was the only place that such a diverse group of Iranians have come together. And when each time you read Balasharin, you definitely are going to get offended. So most people say, when we read Balasharin, it's just we get offended. I say, if you don't get offended, that's when Balasharin has died. It's because the diversity of opinions, there's always something that's going to offend you when you read the website. And it's different from Facebook or other social network where you choose your friends, because once you choose your friends, you are exposed to things that are, you like because it's coming from your friends. But on Balasharin, you are exposed to things that everybody is posting and you don't have a choice and you're reading everybody else is reading. And that's, I think, exposes people to much diverse type of opinions, and that's where the offensiveness comes from.
Let me just pivot from that to ask Nika Hang a little bit about the future of journalism in Iran. You spoke about the kind of citizen journalism phenomenon of 2009, and I think you're of a generation where so many people went into journalism as almost an alternative to political activism. When I would visit Iran in the late 1990s, there were so many young people who were either aspiring journalists or journalists, often the same sort of people, I think, who would have probably been going to Georgetown or SAIS here looking to have jobs in policy positions or in campaigns. But in Iran, they all gravitated toward journalism because that was where you could make a difference. That was where you could express your views and really have some influence on the shape of things. Journalism has been forced to change in Iran because of the repression and because so many phenomenal people have been forced to leave. Do you see electronic media as the future? Do you see young people gravitating in different directions? And what does this mean for the fight for transparency and accountability and democracy in Iran?
I can go through our own experience that we've had since 2009 when we launched khodnevis.org, a citizen journalism platform. That has caused a lot of trouble, of course, in a way, because things have been said on the website that many people don't like. I was thinking that the middle name of Mehdi would be Mehdi Offensive Yahya Nejat from right now. But I think mine would be Nick Insulting Kostar because of what we have on Khodnevis. Yeah, that's the thing. One important factor is that many are looking at alternative media as a basis to start actually acting as journalists. But volunteer journalists, citizen journalists. The thing is, many are actually fed up with what they have seen on state-run TV or newspapers and, let's say, political websites that are supposed to be news websites but are actually partisan websites. We're trying to think of advocacy journalism replacing partisan journalism. We advocate something, but let's see both sides of the story. Many people in Iran do not like to see both sides of the story. And in Iran, we have two prominent soccer teams, Persepolis and Esteghlal, and journalists act as, let's say, fans of each of those teams, of course, in political means, that you're either for the team or against the team. So in Iran, many of us are either for this party or cause or against it. So when we write something, when we broadcast something, we just want to write something that promotes our side and is against the other side. And we don't give the reader a chance to understand what's going on. I think internet has given us the power and tools to introduce many Iranians to what has been going on in other countries, like in the States or in Europe, that, okay, if even you're for a cause, you give enough information about the other side. And this can create a conversation. You'll get a lot of nasty comments, as Mehdi was saying, that I'm, of course, one of the victims on his website. Usually. And sometimes I love it, sometimes I don't love it. That means when he gets an email at Mehdi, watch it. He knows
every
that
every 3 months I get a long email from Nico and complaining about the
He
comments.
Knows that if it goes far on and on, he'll get a bad cartoon. That's the thing. I will change the name of Balatay in a nasty way. He knows what it is. I won't tell you. Yeah. But the thing is, accountability is a very important thing that many news websites actually lack. And keeping the politicians accountable is very important. We have done something that's a little bit unusual, talking about the executions in the 1980s, about human rights abuse, about things that Baha'is have gone through. And also, we have followed a few cases. Some of you might be fed up with this, but we have followed the footsteps of Mr. Rafsanjani's son and going through what he has gone by breaking the law Of course, we're not truly sure that he has broken the law, entering Oxford University or the oil contracts in the 1990s and all those things. So we're following everything. So at least we want to keep somebody who is accountable and also vulnerable right now because he's out of the country. So we're trying to give an example of can be a little bit nasty in journalism in contrast with other very politically correct websites.
One quick question to Henry. You're not off the hook here, even though I suspect you need to be off the record. But I want to actually raise something and quote something that Lely Porzan said this morning in her comments, and it was something that her father said to her before he died, which is that if I am alive, I'm waiting for justice. If I am not, this is your responsibility. And this is obviously all of our responsibility here today. I want to ask you to speak just a little bit about what the U.S. government tries to do in terms of advocating on behalf of those, many of whom are journalists, who've been imprisoned or otherwise harassed in Iran. Many of them are sitting here in this room and have been on either the previous panel or will be on the next panel or are here with us today. Can you just speak a little bit about what it is that the U.S. government does in terms of seeking and waiting for justice?
Sure. On the human rights front, broadly, journalists, yes, but broadly in terms of the justice issue. We have pushed very hard, and I'm happy to report a success because it was a Sisyphean undertaking to get the UN's first special rapporteur for human rights inside Iran. That was victory number one. Victory number two, of course, in that lane is enabling that rapporteur to be effective. We've been doing diplomacy, statecraft, if you prefer, with Iran for 30-plus years offshore. This is not new to American diplomacy. It's what we did with the Soviets for a period of years, not 33 and counting, but it's what we did for a period of years by operating from offshore or having to come up with, if you will, creative and imaginative ways to do everything from bring justice to simply communicate on Iran. So the UN is one mechanism we've worked with in the UN Human Rights Council. This was fought quite literally in Geneva, almost room to room. It was no Stalingrad, and I don't mean to make that comparison, but it was the diplomatic equivalent of hunting down every single vote and going room to room and battling for it in order to get this person appointed. He's done some very good work in terms of working with other governments who'd been fence-sitters before. In the diplomatic lexicon, they're called members of the NAM, the Non-Aligned Movement. We were delighted to see that several of them who had abstained before from voting on human rights issues with regard to Iran had now, in fact, voted. And they voted, in our view, in exactly the right way, which was to hold Iran accountable on a number of human rights issues. So that's one mechanism. Beyond that, of course, we work in terms of supporting with funds and with training a number of other groups who are closer and more proximate to the cause. These are groups who are inside Iran. Civil society activists is the term that we use for them. We train them. We support them. We support them politically in terms of in drawing rooms. We support them from the podium. We've been told time and again from various people who have been in Evin, I don't know if this was your experience at all, but from people who have been in Evin, particularly the longer-term folks, that it was statements and a continuing pressing by the U.S. government that accounted for at least some degree, if not more, it's hard to tell, but accounted for some degree of the treatment that they got that was better treatment, or their release, or a reduction in their sentence. The thing was that we kept the spotlight on them, and we kept raising them. We're continuing to do this worldwide. I think a number of governments in far corners of the globe, far corners from the U.S., were surprised to see planes land and to see U.S. diplomats trot in and talk to them about Iran and not mention sanctions or P5 plus one or the nuclear file, but instead say, hi, we know you're on the Human Rights Council. We're here to talk to you today about human rights in Iran. They knew that in these cases, in a number of cases, it took us several days of flying to get there, i.e. it wasn't in Western Europe. But they were key votes that were needed,
and we were there and we were pushing it. So in summary, we're activists on this on a number of different fronts, again, in the public, but also diplomatically and things that are not seen in the public arena.
Thank you. Let me open it up to the audience and continue the conversation for a few more minutes. We'll start. Kareem, did you have a question?
Thank you for a wonderful panel. I have a question for Nico Hang and for Mehdi, maybe along the lines of what Suzanne asked. But Mehdi, you were talking about how Iran has this cyber army which goes around the internet posting comments in favor of the regime and attacking dissidents and attacking them in a personal way. How do you exercise restraint on both of your websites when the site is overtaken by these types of commentators? On one hand, you want to foster this culture of democracy and openness. On the other hand, you're dealing with, you know, in some cases, perhaps official representatives of the state who are out to kind of discredit folks. So how do you reconcile that? How do you manage that?
Since it's really hard to tell who is who and the users are anonymous, it's really hard to say who is a cyber officer and who is just like another dissident group. In fact, Nick Kohang is a target of a lot of these anonymous comments. And each time I get an email from him, I usually wait for 3 days until he gets less angry. And then I write back that you are a public figure, just get used to it. So this is we can't do much about it. I mean, that's just the part of the game, and people have to get used to what, some of these attacks are just what public figure are going to get. And if there is going to be a democracy in Iran, these things are not going to stop. And since I can't tell who is who, it's hard to stop such things. But I definitely know it's really annoying. And I've been personally exposed to it. And I know it doesn't feel good. And it makes you really angry when it's persistent over time. And Nico Hank knows quite well about such attacks. So
we have experienced a lot of DDoS attacks in the past 3 months. And sometimes even we have it on a daily basis, and we know at what time are we going to receive that attack. So we don't publish anything, let's say, between 9:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m., usually, because we know our fans from the Cyber Army or any other fans. From Britain, actually. We have received a lot of attacks from Britain. That's interesting. I don't know who lives in Britain. Oxford, possibly. The thing is, in 2010, we published a story, and we wrote it was false news, based on farce news, but false news, that the cyber army has attacked the website of the Mehrabad airport. The officials took it seriously. And one of the deputy ministers said that, oh, these guys of the cyber army are our friends and work for the government. Oh, that was the first time that they actually had to say something like that. So we, in a way, we forced them to actually confess. It wasn't on Sunday, so it wasn't a Sunday confession, but it was a confession. Good enough. We use newsletters. We use many of our members have actually their own Facebook pages, so they publish whatever they publish on our website on their Facebook pages. So the information is actually going all around. We don't have a clear record of, let's say, when a cartoon is posted on the website and has, let's say, 5,000 visitors, we don't know really how many times the cartoon has been visited on web. And Bulletin is actually one of the best places for us to have the cartoons distributed and being seen, or all the content that we have on the website. And even if when the website is hacked, there's a summary of an article on Bulletin, so people can actually follow up with what we've had. So it's not really easy for the Iranian government and the cyber army to bring information down, but it's a struggle, and it's an ongoing struggle. And I don't believe the numbers when they say that half of the Iranian public are actually connected through the web. I think the best number was 11%, actually, and that's truthful. Okay, people were saying that 30 million Iranians are connected online. No, it's not true. It cannot be true. Let's say 10 million. That's a little bit close to that's accurate. So, and people coming on Bolotarian and other social or political websites, they're no more than, I think, 2 million, probably at most 3 million. And so we have a minority of people online. So I think there should be an investment not only on internet connection, but also on broadcast, on satellite broadcast, and giving the people in Iran a chance. But the people active on the web, like political activists or journalists, must have a chance to actually broadcast whatever they are writing online on those new satellite channels, but not like the ones that we have in L.A.
Great. Can we get a mic right here?
Thank you very much. I'm Benjamin, too. I have a question for Mr. Wooster. You spoke about a virtual embassy. Now, the Iranians have an interest section in Washington, and they have Iranian representatives here. We have an interest section in Tehran, but we have no representatives there. I wonder why that is, since it would give us greater insight into the people, the policies, the society. It would reduce the likelihood of inadvertent conflict through miscalculation or some other reason, and it would help us perhaps with access to U.S. citizens that are imprisoned in Iran. What is the administration's position on having Americans at the intersection?
Thank you. Because of the lack of diplomatic relations, we don't have U.S. diplomats in Tehran. And in fact, the Iranians don't have, they do not have Iranian officials here. The U.S. interest section is not staffed by Iranian diplomats. There are no Iranian diplomats in it. So it is on a parallel to the structure we have with the Swiss protecting power in Tehran. In terms of your points about would presence on the ground redound to our benefit in the ways that you outlined, it would. But right now we've got some bigger obstacles that are in the way.
Ambassador Toscano?
I just have a comment. I know that what you, Mehdi and Nick, have described can be perceived as problematic because it opened up the possibility for guys we really don't like to express themselves. But there are two things. First of all, the plurality of voices that you are addressing. And second, the fact that you have to be critical also for the side that basically you agree with, let's say. We are not neutral. I am not neutral. Nobody here, I think, is neutral vis-a-vis a repressive regime. And yet, what you do not want is to resemble your adversary. You do not want to censor yourself because you don't like something. You don't want to be so partisan that you distort the reality. I think the best chance for freedom and democracy is not to hide reality, even when reality is unpleasant.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to add one. Being neutral, but at the same time, so, I mean, the Bolotarian team, all the volunteers who are helping Bolotarian because they want to see democracy in Iran. So that's very clear for them. But at the same time, we want to be neutral for the running the site and allow all these different voices to be present. So it's been an ongoing issue to how to balance these things. And what we've learned is for this site, in fact, I've seen it, for example, like for U.S. government, for Voice of America, they have such issues. Or, I mean, anytime you have a media that's funded for a partisan reason, but at the same time you want to be having neutral purpose, you run to such issues. So in case of Bolotarian, all these volunteers are working there for a reason, but at the same time the website needs to be neutral. What we did was basically we found out what things have to remain neutral, like the posting of the content, voting system, and so on. But at the same time, we found areas that we could show which side we are on. And for example, the banner of the site, we change it on occasions to show sympathy with democratic movement or human rights issues and so on. And that's the control of the banner is with the team of Bahrain, and nobody really can complain that why you had such a banner or not. So it's really important to distinguish which areas you could show your sympathy and you could show your which side you are on and what areas you need to stay neutral.
One part that we are actually sensitive to is libel. One discussion that I have with Mehdi is sometimes the comments and the things that are going on his website, because they don't have, it's a, they receive hundreds of links every minute, so it's very hard for them to monitor what's going on. We don't have this problem on our portal. We get probably 20 articles, 30 articles a day, and we have to read them, but they get hundreds, so they're bombarded. One thing is to control, in a way, what's being posted as comments, because you don't know the person who's posting the comment, and I think there has to be a way to actually monitor the comments being posted, because they might ruin everything sometimes. We want to play, let's say, by the Guardian's rules on how people post comments. We want to have a conversation. The whole thing of creating a website is to create a good conversation. You can't bet on everything to be constructive, but at least you want to show some respect for both sides. And also you need to verify some stuff, like when somebody is attacking a person on the website, you need documents, you need to verify what's going on. That's a side that we are a little bit too sensitive about, and it's really hard to understand for maybe to verify those things. That's the only limitations that we have.
More questions? I just want to get a show of hands because we've got about 10 more minutes. Questions? I know Mehrdad. Let me take two at a time in two groups and then get some responses. Mehrdad? And over here.
Thank you. My question goes to Mehdi and Nick at the same time, because you touched on the adversary comments being offensive or sometimes insulting to the even the opposition groups, which is good in a way to hold them accountable, that's something good. But at the same time, we are talking about a diaspora society with no mainstream media, with sometimes no channels, proper channels of communication, and perhaps and under systematic organized attack by a government which is against the freedom of expression. So to what extent these adversary comments or articles or news could accommodate the efforts by the Islamic regime or work in the same direction where the opposition groups or individuals or public figures such as yourself and many others who have perhaps no, as I said, no mainstream media, proper channels of communications to defend the act or their actions that they have been criticized for. So I think my question is, it's different when we look at the United States or any other democratic country where there is mainstream media, of course, on the side there is Onion and many others who hold even the opposition accountable, versus a diaspora community which is in a fierce battle with a government to actively persecute activists and political figures even outside the country. Thank you.
Okay, just before you respond, let me get one other question and we'll take that. In the back here.
Thank you very much for such a great panel. My name is Behnam. I'm an Elliott School student. My question is for Mr. Worcester, actually, about the social media and the communications initiative you outlined. Where do you see U.S. public diplomacy in terms of just generic speeches and presidential engagement with the Iranian people going? Is it still in the contours of the older notion of the bully pulpit, or is it moving into a new phase like an umbrella to encompass all these?
Okay, who would like to start with responses?
So there is a, I'll go ahead. So there is a clear template when people want to like damage somebody's reputation. This is, so the template is you take some facts that are true, mix it with things that are really damaging, mix them up, you put it up. And what happens is people who know that person, they see the facts and they say, okay, this part is true. And But these are the other things we don't know, and they must be true because there are some facts into this. And this is a clear template. It's used repeatedly by whoever, I mean, whether it's Iranian government or other dissident groups who want to attack somebody else and so on. And they might know the clear formula, but this is what they're doing. It's very hard to defend against it because once you engage, you have to say which part is the fact, which part is not. And sometimes even you don't want to disclose the fact. It was something you wanted to keep private. And especially if it's something personal related to your family, your sexual life, whatever, it's really sensitive and people don't want to even engage, involve in it. And it's so, and but by doing that, people who are doing the attack, in some cases, they want to damage the reputation right away. In some cases, they want to draw the person to get engaged and disclose the facts that they kept secret before. Because that's what they want to get the person involved in. So defending against some of this is really hard. And in fact, the best defense is to just state, I mean, to decide what your public picture is. Repeat it as often as you can in your blog, in your, I mean, whenever you give a talk or whatever, and not engage with such attacks. Because the minute you engage, you are verifying some of the facts you kept secret. And also you try to get into territories that it's defined by your enemy. And in cases, for example, I've seen dissidents who really take these things personally. I've, like, in fact, there are a few of them in this room that I know, and they've complained to me on Bahrain because of the attacks they received on Bahrain. What I see them doing is answering people in those comment sections, trying to deny those accusations. And that's just a mistake, because the minute you do this, you are giving satisfaction to the attacker. You are verifying some of the facts, and you are also defined by that person. So it's just, I think the thing is, there isn't much I could do, because I don't know which part of those statements are fact, which ones are not true. So I have to leave them on the site, because it's something up to people to decide. It's up to the person who's been attacked to go and define their image in a positive way and not engage with those individuals.
On what you said about having articles that are criticizing, I don't call them insulting or even offensive in that way, criticizing different political groups and leaders for not being clear and not being accountable, I think that's important for democracy in Iran. That means when, for instance, let's say there's a conference, but you don't have members of the media over there monitoring what's happening and monitoring the conversations, okay, a few questions will be raised. And then you don't know how a meeting is taking place and the people over there want to represent themselves as the whole opposition in a way. Okay, there are a lot of questions because so many members of the opposition were not in that meeting. So just keeping people accountable about what they're doing would, I think, help democracy in Iran and free speech as well. And asking questions is one of the most important things that we have been scared of for generations. And I think it's time to ask those questions right now and to show the Iranian public that it's important to ask.
Okay, I have a question. I'm not sure I heard both parts of that. It's included as,
where's public diplomacy going? Okay. There's a recognition, and there has been already for some time, that it's a different world than most of us who've been in the department for a while have grown up with. So we grew up in the era of the controlled message, barely a hair removed from the quill pen. Media, you know, technology has really pushed us. We can't be like that anymore. So, a long story short, it's a much more dynamic environment. There's more accountability. There's a much more agility and fluidity. There is authority that is delegated down now in ways that it didn't used to be when I signed up. There's a lot more innovation and, in fact, an encouragement to innovate. There is also, and I never thought I would see this day, but a degree of deliberate tolerance of and, in fact, encouragement of some amount of chaos in the sense that you can't control the exponential electronic growth in the, you know, from phones and Twitters to internet to God knows what number of platforms, that you have to just, you have to enable some of that and let it run. So we obviously are going to, in terms of our public diplomacy and what comes off the podium as this is the official position of the United States government on X, that's going to be controlled in the more traditional ways. But in terms of engagement with people, and particularly countries with whom we have no access, Iran, no diplomatic relations, are very difficult to access others. The new media tools are very much encouraged.
I am going to renege on my promise to take another round of questions because I know that you are all probably eagerly awaiting the next step in our program, which is a brief moment to grab lunch before our third and final panel begins. I want to just say a word of thanks because I think what we heard in this discussion was a really, really important and interesting building on the first conversation and leading toward what I think is going to be a great finale. You know, the difficulties and the progress that the U.S. government has made in trying to communicate with a country that we have no direct means of diplomatic interface, and the new challenges that are brought about in a world of you know, this fascinating conversation, this incredibly active and engaged Iranian political debate, and the opportunities as well as the challenges that technology creates for that conversation. So I really want to thank the panelists so much, and it has been just an honor to be part of this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.